Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. This week, we're traveling the globe to investigate innovative ways that creative people are growing food and beverage businesses, large and small. We'll start off big with Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen CEO, Cheryl Batchelder. With hard work, determination, and most of all, a desire to serve, Cheryl turned around a business that was stagnant and declining. Wait till you hear how. Then, we traveled to London to meet Ryan Chetiawadana, more easily known as Mr. Lion. Mr. Lion was named the International Bartender of the Year in 2015 at Tales of the Cocktail. His London bar, the White Lion, is the first in the world to use no perishables at all. No fruit, no ice, and consequently, no waste. Then, how would you like to enjoy a lovely libation while having your locks trimmed at the tonsorial parlor? That's the experience that Mikey Enright offers at his business, The Barbershop in Sydney, Australia. So climb on board and get ready for some inspiring business innovation ideas on this week's Louisiana Eats. When I first met Cheryl Batchelder at a Popeye's event in New Orleans, I had no idea she was the company's CEO. That's because Cheryl is a true champion of servant leadership. The idea that powerful executives lead with the belief that they are not the most important person in the company. Cheryl delivered this theory of leadership in her acclaimed book, Dare to Serve: How to Drive Superior Results by Serving Others. Here's Cheryl to discuss just how she walks the walk. You grew up in a very special family, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I was blessed. I am the oldest of four children. There are three girls and the youngest is a boy. And we were blessed to have parents that were just totally focused on preparing their kids for the world. My parents raised four business leaders. I'm the oldest, as I said, running Popeyes. The next one has started and sold to software companies in the healthcare industry. The next one runs a really cool hospital in North Carolina and the western part of the state. And then my brother runs a water engineering operation out of New Jersey. And so somehow my parents created the conditions so that we could give the world our best talents, right? We each have different talents, and they were able to tease those out of us and get us on a good start. I would tell you that the most important thing they taught us was not skills about finance or marketing or any of those things. The most important thing they taught us was how to live our life, what kind of values, what kind of character traits would make us effective leaders. And I'm eternally grateful to them. In fact, my mother still lives with me today, so I still get a lot of good counsel.
One of the credos that really you all grew up by was that your altitude is your attitude.
Absolutely. In fact, my daughters would tell you that they woke up to those words just about every day of their teenage life, because as you might know, teenagers don't always wake up in a good place. But I really wanted to give to them the perspective that they were in charge of their attitude, and their day would turn out exactly the way they started their day and where they were coming from. And so my mother did that for me. She woke me up every morning with loud music, usually church music, which I didn't always like that much. But she wanted me to bound out of bed with my head in the right place And that's what I tried to do with my daughters. I now do it to the people that work with me. They may feel the same way as my daughters, but they tolerate me because I think they've seen the impact of positive mindsets on the outcomes of Popeyes. We go into things thinking good outcomes will come. We go in with a good attitude towards people. We assume the best. And our outcomes have been above average.
Cheryl, you've had such a long, amazing career with powerhouse companies. At what points in your life did you have these experiences?
Well, you know, I actually have to think about the ages of my children to even remember that. But my first child was born when I was at Lifesavers in the mid-80s. And that was a very fun time of learning and everything about the candy business. When I went to Domino's in the mid-90s, about 1995, I had my second daughter in tow, Katie. And so those are two markers along the road. The third would be I came to Popeyes 8 years ago in the fall of 2007, and this has been the fastest and the most fun section of my career.
Before even coming to Popeyes, you really have left your mark. I couldn't believe it when I read that if it weren't for you working for Tom Monahan, who was, of course, head of Domino's, people might still be getting cold pizza instead of hot pizza at their door.
Well, that was one of the most fun initiatives that I got to lead while I was at Domino's Pizza. What had happened before is you did your level best. You took a hot pizza, you put it in a polyester bag, which frankly kind of not only did it cool down, but it got kind of soggy, and you rushed to the home with the pizza. And so the heat wave bag, which we designed and implemented at Domino's before any competitor, was created to keep the oven temperature all the way to the door. And it was a really tough project to get people excited about inside the company because it was so new. I called it a sixth grade science project when we started. You know, it was made, it was a prototype, it had wires taped to it with duct tape. It just didn't look real promising in its first stage. So it didn't go fast, but after the seventh time we discussed it in our leadership team meeting, we finally got our risk behaviors lined up and said, you know what, we're going to take a risk. We're going to be first. We're going to be bold. And I believe it really changed the trajectory of Domino's Pizza. We had 5 years of positive sales after that and have been ahead of the competitors ever since.
I think that it's a cornerstone of anyone's character to have, along with great successes, disappointments and failures along the way. That's what really gives you your character in the long run. And so everything wasn't always a bed of roses for you. You were at KFC and your job there didn't work out.
That's right. You can say it even more directly. I got fired. let's be honest. And I say it almost exactly the way you said it, which is success does not always make us stronger, but trials do. Trials make us better, stronger. They change us forever. And I've had a few of them in my life. This was one of them. But whether it's illness or losing your job or having a challenge with a child, you know, in any different way that life throws it at you, it humbles you. And I would tell you that getting fired was a really important part of my leadership journey because it kind of brought me to the end of myself. You know, none of my tricks worked. In that assignment, I fell short. I didn't have all that I needed to be effective. It humbled me. It made me get back to learning some of the skills that I needed. And interestingly, this idea that a leader is at their best when they reach the end of their self has really been the premise with which I've led Popeyes. And I think I was changed forever by that. There would be no Dare to Serve book if I hadn't come to the end of myself first and the realization that I need to approach leadership with a very humble heart and realize that I need a lot of other talented people around me. I need to create an environment for them to succeed. It is not all about me.
Well, that is what you refer to as the spotlight problem. And that was a concept that kind of bent my brain a little bit, that leaders should not be in the spotlight.
You know, the spotlight problem is a very important one to wrestle with in the restaurant business, because if the CEO was the most important person, I would be at a cash register serving our food to our guest, because that is the most important person. That's the point of contact between our amazing Louisiana food and the guest who gives us the opportunity to serve them with our business. And so that's a really important concept, is for me to never feel the need to be the center of things when the center of our business model sits in the restaurant at the front counter with our guest. But interestingly, Poppy, then in our culture, spotlight leadership is the only kind of leadership we celebrate. We put leaders on magazine covers in spotlights. We celebrate their personal ambition, their personal accomplishments. We celebrate their jets, their beach houses, whatever, right? All the superficial things that come with power and wealth and ambition. And we very seldom turn the spotlight on the people that did all the work to make that enterprise incredibly successful. And so I talk about the spotlight problem because I think it's the first wake-up call leaders get at saying, oh my goodness, here I am. We're all subject to this, right? Taking all the credit, thinking I'm so important when the most important people aren't even here in the room. I have a friend who's a choir director. His name is Eric. And Eric said, think about this. I'm in charge of picking the music, preparing the choir, rehearsing them to perfection. But when we sing in front of that audience, I'm the least important person in the room. And I think that says it all. A great leader should be invisible. The outcome, the incredible performance of the people is what should shine.
When we come back from a short break, our conversation with Cheryl Batchelder continues as she reveals the secrets of great leadership. Stay tuned. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from the Napoleon House, historic charm in the heart of the French Quarter, home of the Pimm's Cup cocktail and the toasted muffalata. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 500 Charter Street. And now, our conversation with Cheryl Batchelder, CEO of Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, continues.
Servant leadership is a word that's been around a really long time. And I like to provoke a conversation about it because a lot of people think serving others is like soft and you like hug everybody and it's all happy, happy. But the hard part of servant leadership is thinking about others more often than yourself. And if you think about how hard that is to do, when we come to work in the morning, we're all focused on ourselves, what our day is going to look like, what we've got to get done, what's important to us. And then to go into your first meeting and say, okay, all I'm going to think about right now is you, that is really hard to do. And so the test in my mind of a servant leader is if they can set aside all that natural me stuff and say, okay, now I'm here to serve this team who's assembled to make some decision for this business. And I've got to give them my very best, but I've got to think about how to set them up for success and make sure that the outcome is good for the people. There's a great quote from Jim Collins who says, a great leader has a terrifying iron will and ambition, for the people in the enterprise, not for themselves. And that's a powerful definition of what a servant leader looks like.
Until I read in your book, and with all of the cross-references to the pieces in the media, I had no idea that one of the reasons that Popeyes sort of sets itself apart from other franchise businesses is because of your relationship with the franchise owners. But traditionally, franchise owners have often been at odds with the franchise itself.
That is absolutely true. And it was true at Popeyes in 2007 when I came to this company. There was almost outright warfare between the franchise owners and the franchisor, who was the corporate owner. And they were not aligned, they were not working together, and they were not enjoying any kind of success. And as I look back on that, one of the decisions we made that really set us apart from our competitors is we made the health of that relationship a top priority. I call it choosing whom we would serve. And we said we would only measure our success by their success. So we asked franchise owners, what's important to you? They said, we need to make money for this to work. Simple, clear, measurable. And we said, okay, we will start measuring the profitability of every restaurant, and we will only consider ourselves a success if that profitability improves. It improved from 17% restaurant operating profit to this year, it's about 23% restaurant operating profit. Our sales have grown, our customer experience has improved, and they're making more money. Proof that we have learned to work in an aligned, collaborative fashion with our owners. I'll tell you one more secret weapon is we actually decided that we love franchisees. Now, that also may need to be obvious, but it's not in this business. We've decided to treat them with respect, to listen to their ideas, to work with them together to solve problems instead of telling them we're so smart we have the answer. And that collaboration slows us down at the beginning. But boy, once we agree, we go fast.
Anybody who has followed the brand is familiar with some pretty drastic changes that you've made. I mean, my goodness, you changed the name of the company.
Yes, we did.
And you all thought you had it all figured out with a new restaurant design, but that didn't work out, did it?
No, we started with changing the name to Louisiana Kitchen, Popeyes Louisiana Kitchen, to give us a wider berth for product innovation and really owning our Louisiana roots. And that part wasn't too hard because it didn't cost any money to change the name initially. But when it came time to remodel the restaurants, that's big capital. That's an investment on the part of the owners. When we first brought to them the idea of remodeling, they didn't like the design, they thought it was too expensive, and they thought it was premature because our sales were still not positive. And they said to us, you know what, take a pause, bring us a better design for half the money, and get sales up, and then we'll talk. Well, most teams like mine would have said, I'm mad, I'm going to argue with you, I'm going to win this case. But I'm so grateful my team had the courage and the humility to go back home and regroup. And they said, you know what, we're going to do just that. We're going to get a design that they like. We're going to find a way to make it cheaper. And we're going to wait another 2 years till sales are cranking good, and then we'll bring it back. And because we listened and followed their lead, we brought back a remodel that they did swiftly throughout our system.
Is it still a valid number that you currently have about 300 franchise owners?
Yes.
And how many Popeyes are there in the world right now?
2,500.
I remember the first time somebody told me how many Popeyes you have in Korea.
We have 100 in Korea, to be exact, and we have about 130 in the country of Turkey.
130 in Turkey. Is it all just delicious fried chicken? Or when you go into other cultures with a franchise concept, how much do you have to alter the concept?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We really think we're exporting this amazing Louisiana food to the world. And the world loves chicken, loves seafood, loves spice and loves rice, and that's what we sell. And so you'd be amazed, the core menu is identical in flavor, profile, and preparation everywhere in the world. Now, we do tweak side dishes. For example, in Korea, they absolutely hate coleslaw, so we don't sell it. There's no point. They eat kimchi, a very spicy fermented cabbage, and that's their version of cabbage. And so we adjust the menu to local taste. We'll offer unique sauces, dipping sauces, for example. Some countries like sandwiches, so we might have a spicy chicken sandwich in addition to our famous bona fide bone-in chicken. Adaptations, yes, but the core is exactly what you would expect if you were eating on Canal Street in New Orleans. We love the fact that foodies love our food, and we're so proud to be able to serve the kind of food that a chef appreciates, the preparation, the flavor, the complexity of red beans and rice. You know, Paul Prudhomme used to say that that's the best red beans and rice on the planet. I can't make it better. And so we're proud to be part of that culinary heritage and hope we always live up to it for our guests.
Cheryl Batchelder, CEO of Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and author of Dare to Serve. Ryan Chathiawadena's name might be hard to pronounce, but the brilliant young Brit is already a legend in the international cocktail community. Ryan has twice won the title of UK Bartender of the Year before opening White Lion in London in 2013, where he's really shaking things up, and not with a cocktail shaker. At White Lion, you can't order a gin and tonic because Mr. Lion, as Ryan is known, has everything batched and ready to go. So how did Ryan Chathiawadena become Mr. Lion?
Well, it was a childhood nickname, actually. So when we were kids, I think it was just, you know, Ryan Lion. It became very easy for people. So, you know, it became kind of adulterated into that. But when I was working on different projects, it was difficult having a name that's very long, very unpronounceable. You see it on a page and it looks daunting.
Yes, it does.
So when we came to trying to jumping across different projects, Mr. Lion as a moniker became much easier.
Though he has a renowned reputation as a bartender, Mr. Lion is best known for innovation, and he's got the education to back that up. He studied biology and philosophy in school before deciding to become a chef.
Well, it was actually partly through suggestion, partly quite organically. So the chefing side was before I was heading down to art college. I just, you know, we grew up in a food that was, you know, food was so important to us. You know, it was a big part of our family life growing up, and it was something I wanted to take on a bit more of the professional knowledge. So went enrolled to train as a chef. But it was quite quickly, there was bits of it I loved. You know, I'd been studying biology, so a lot of the kind of the practical food science stuff was easily applicable to me. The professional knowledge, the skill set, kind of learning all those things was incredible. But it became quickly apparent to me that it was very alien towards the way I cooked. You know, I loved having people in my house, having people around, cooking for them, knowing what they liked, being able to just chat to them at the same time. So it was my best friend, he just recommended, he said, you know, you could do a switch to the bar. You're still working with flavors, food. Well, you know, same idea, but you get to chat to people and get to, you know, tailor things to people's tastes much more in the way that I saw food. So didn't look back from there.
Well, it was really a smart move for you because you've won many awards since you began your career behind the bar, including UK Bartender of the Year.
Yeah, I was very fortunate with a couple of them. I was actually lucky enough to take that twice, different years and very different kind of scenarios, different competitions. But it was, I was very fortunate. I had interest in both science and arts, and it was an opportunity to kind of fuse those two. So I think it became I think what I was creating within the industry was a little different, and I was learning off incredible people, and it was just well-timed with a lot of things, I think.
I'm fascinated that now you're setting out to really turn the cocktail world as we know it on its ear with your new business, White Lion, L-Y-A-N. And tell us about how you're shaking things up without using a cocktail shaker.
It's shaking things up without using anything that's usually found in a cocktail bar. And it was, yeah, it's been a real kind of labor of love, that project has been. It's an idea I had about 3 years ago now. And it was done as a means of, you know, I love this industry. I love all the things that go on, all the different approaches to how to put together a cocktail. But it was, you know, it was partly that I was intrigued to see where there are other ways of putting together a cocktail. And thankfully there are. It's, you know, what we've tried to do is take away some of the best parts of a bar. And to me, that was the ability a bar has and a cocktail has to kind of lift your mood. You know, we set up a bar that was very much aimed at allowing us to do what I see as the kind of real crux of bartending, and that's hosting people.
Yes.
So it's, there is the aspect of what we've done to the drink side, but the real kind of focus was looking after people. You know, a lot of my friends aren't in the industry, and so they were put off by cocktails. Sometimes they felt that the bars were, you know, a little elitist. A lot of the time that they felt that, you know, there'd be a big wait on a cocktail. They'd wait 20 minutes for a drink and it'd cost them $20. And they would be, you know, it wouldn't match that expectation. So what we wanted to do was flip that on its head. So allow us to really spend time with people, take away a lot of their, you know, their preconceptions of everything about a cocktail bar, take away a lot of their fallbacks at the same time. So you can't come in and order just a gin and tonic.
Yes.
Although I love a gin and tonic, it was fun to kind of get people to start to look at their drinks differently. So we try and spend time with them, find out what they need that drink to do for them. And then we try and match that with one of our drinks. And given the nature of the way we put together the drinks, we can serve them very quickly. Even when we're four deep at the bar, we think we can get a drink out in a good kind of 10 or 20 seconds.
Because you're batching everything.
That's correct. Yeah. So it's like a kitchen. So, you know, I always say that if you, and from my background, I know this, you know, no chef makes your food on the spot. It would take you hours to dine in a restaurant if you were, you know, everything was made a la minute. So we take the same principle. We prepare things ahead of time, which actually allows us, you know, from our side, which is very much on our side, is we can be really geeky about all the details. We start with our water, literally at the starting point. So we filter it, remineralize it, use that to make our spirits. So we control it at that stage. We make all the cordials, the distillates, or we get people to make it. If we can't make it the best that we would like, we partner with people. And we control all the drinks behind the scenes, set it up like a kitchen. So when it comes to service, we're just finishing drinks. So there'll be there's a sense of theater still. There's that final flourish, but you're not waiting long on the drink. So all of the balance is in place already. So the drinks are always consistent as well. So nobody has to worry about it being served different from a different bartender. But they come out very quick. And by all the work we put into kind of bring everything in house, we save a lot of money. So
of
we
course.
Can pass that saving on, in fact. So our drinks, we hope, are very well priced as well.
I can't resist asking you this question because, you know, we have all been inundated with ice education over the last few years. So what's your position on that, Ryan?
Well, I think it's great. It's one of the things that has been shown about the way people have moved with the industry and how these things have become a conversation is how that professionalism has lifted. So people aren't just now happy enough to go, right, I'm going to use hotel ice that's chipped and wet and small to make my craft cocktail. They're looking at every one of those elements, and the strength lies in the weakest link in the chain.
Yes.
And so if your ice is terrible, your drink's going to be terrible. It's a kind of integral part of the drink. So as long as people are focusing on that, I think it's really important. And it's something that, you know, I'm using ice in other projects, and I'm just trying to be wary of how I use that ingredient because it's a key ingredient. It's really nice that once we opened White Lion, it stimulated a discussion. It's forced people to look at their product and say, you know, fine, we're not going to do what White Lion does and take away these things. We're still using ice and citrus, but are we using it in the best way possible? And it's been amazing to see people use different acidulants, different uses of their lemons, using their lemons more instead of just squeezing them and throwing them in the bin. It's been, you know, one of the big things that we've kickstarted, hopefully, is a conversation about waste.
Yes.
And so how people use a lot of these ingredients in a more conscientious manner.
Yeah, that's fascinating because there's no citrus. There's no wedge of lime in the glass. There's none of that at White Lion.
That's correct. Yeah, there's, you know, and it was something that was constant frustration for me. You know, I've worked in some bars that I'm super proud of and super, like, excited by still, but you'd be squeezing fresh lemons and you'd be throwing away a bin bag full, like a heavy bag full of just lemon husks. And there's still flavor in those things. You know, you've paid a lot of money to ship them across the world. I think it's a shame that you just throw half of it away. And partly that was partly a frustration on it, because you can recreate like lemon. If we want to at White Lion, we can recreate a lemon. We use it in one ingredient that we call it a turbocharged lemon, where using a blend of different acids, distillates, and sugars, we create a lemon that's almost amplified in flavor. But that wasn't the motivation for us. It wasn't saying how we could cheat a lemon. It was more that, you know, I didn't want to just be throwing things away and using things that were constantly changed depending on where they came from in the world. It was, you know, it was important to me to use ingredients that, you know, particularly in the UK, actually, to go back to the citrus, it was difficult to get good citrus fruit.
Yeah.
So it'd be from India one time, Mexico the next, and, you know, the flavor would change, the pH would change, the oils, all of these things would be hugely different, and yet everybody would follow the same recipe. And that seemed odd to me, whereas if you could create something that was consistent, you could then put together a drink that you were proud of and putting out, and you could serve in a kind of, in a regular manner. But it, again, it's not that I'm against lemons. It's just, I think if you're using an ingredient like that is natural, embrace the fact that it's natural. It's a fantastic thing. It's got, you know, it's got its own nuances, and you should be able to play up to that and use it in a way that uses all the characteristics of the fruit rather than just going, it's a lemon and I'm going to throw it into my drink.
Well, I'm curious, with all of the arduous training and the posturing of the craft bar chef, what is the reaction from your peers?
We were worried about that at first, actually. We weren't sure that people would rebel against and, well, actually misread why we were doing what we were doing. And thankfully, actually, once people came into the bar, it was very different. I think before we actually opened the doors, people had formed in their mind what the bar was or wasn't about. And it was really nice that actually people were very quick to, you know, swallow that. Once they came in, they were, you know, they saw that it was done for the right reasons. We were there to look after people and just give people a good time and offer drinks that we thought were of the highest quality. So it wasn't about kind of taking anything away and diminishing the cocktail craft. It was offering something different. And we're still very much a promoter of everything around us. The people who are doing things with passion and for the right reasons, we, you know, we send our customers down to them. It's a different experience to what we offer, and we think that's really important.
Since you're turning the cocktail industry on its ear right now with your new way of doing cocktails, do you maybe have a glimpse into what might be coming next?
It's easier to answer from a personal perspective. I'm always fascinated what's coming from around the world, and hopefully some of the stuff we've done is going to kickstart people to look at a few other different projects than there is out there. But from my perspective, in terms of where I'm pushing the company, is, you know, for the last few years, I've had, well, about 6 or 7 different bar concepts in my head that I think I would love to bring to fruition in and around the reasonable timing of now. So I think it's very important that you fit within the timing of the wider landscape. I mean, you know, it's some of the ideas I have now, when the opportunity comes, they may no longer be relevant. You know, I constantly want to feel inspired by what we're doing. So I never want to rest on our laurels or feel like we're sitting still with anything. Everything will continue to evolve. So White Lion will still continue to evolve as well. I don't think it will ever be that, you know, we're never going to change. It's not that we're going to revert the concept. I'm very proud of that. But we'll continue to add new things to it and build it up in a way that we think is taking it in the right way.
That's fantastic. Well, I want to thank you so much for bringing your inspiring story of innovation and creation to Louisiana Eats. So thank you, Ryan.
Pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Bartender and innovator Ryan Chathiawadana.
Blow away dandelion.
How do you successfully fry up a batch of chicken? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
Dandelions don't care about the time.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How do you successfully fry up a batch of chicken? Fried chicken does take time to prepare. First, the chicken must be soaked in a well-spiced buttermilk brine for a minimum of 4 hours, but overnight is best. When you're ready to start cooking, remove the chicken from the refrigerator and let it sit at room temperature for 30 minutes. In a deep skillet, heat your favorite cooking oil, vegetable, canola, or peanut, to 360 degrees. Season some flour with salt, cayenne pepper, and a little paprika. The paprika helps the chicken brown. For a little extra crunchiness, you can add a bit of cornmeal as well. Beat an egg into the buttermilk brine and roll the chicken pieces in flour. Wet them again in the buttermilk and egg mixture, and then one more time back into the seasoned flour. My favorite way to bread chicken is to put the seasoned flour in a brown grocery bag and give it all a good shake. Add the chicken pieces to the hot oil and keep an eye on the oil temperature as it needs to remain constant at about 350 degrees. Cover the skillet and let the chicken fry for 6 minutes. Then fry it uncovered for an additional 9 minutes before turning the pieces over in the pan and repeating the process. The more times you turn the chicken in the hot oil, the greasier it will become, so try to keep that to a minimum. Don't be afraid to use a meat thermometer to check the internal temperature of the chicken. When it's done, the meat should be at 165 degrees. Remove the chicken from the pan and don't put it on a paper towel. Let the chicken drain on a wire rack for 10 minutes before serving. Are you exhausted just listening to this process? Remember, there's always the nearest Popeye's drive-thru. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
Opportunities are available in all walks of life in Australia. So if you're young,
Mikey Enright's desire to become a barber transported him across the globe to a world of scissors and jiggers down under. Now, he owns a combination vintage barbershop and speakeasy-style gin bar in Sydney, Australia called What Else? The Barbershop. These days, Mikey is pushing boundaries on a regular basis. During a visit to New Orleans, Mikey gave us a glimpse of his innovative business pairing.
I kind of wanted to create an environment that was a day business and a night business. It's very hard to open a cocktail bar in Sydney, Australia, and trade during the day. People don't drink cocktails in the day like they do in New Orleans. And so I wanted to have a day business originally, but also I wanted to combine, you know, the craft of the cocktail with, you know, with the skill of a barber, and then combine those two lifestyles together so that you can have a great drink whilst you kind of get your hair cut or your beard trimmed or styled or whatever you like.
So have people begun drinking in the daytime too, because the barbershop's open in the daytime?
Yes.
Oh, you corrupter. You corrupter of people just looking for a little trim. So How has that evolved? Tell me about how you've changed that pattern.
Well, you know, the barbershop thing, people started getting haircut at hairdressers and that kind of stuff over the last 20, 30, 40 years. There's a renaissance with the barbershop. You know, guys, generally men, are going back to getting the haircut at barbershops again and having that tradition and that sort of style of thing. So I just wanted to bring that back too, you know. So, and it works harmoniously with the bar. We have lots of different packages where people can have whiskey flights with certain sort of haircuts and whatever they haven't done.
Describe for me how you have seen that culture shift since you're shaking things up.
Well, I think, you know, in Sydney, Australia, the population is very small. You know, it's not like a big city like New York or London where there are lots of people about in the daytime. So, you know, come Thursday, Friday, people do drink in the daytime, but generally not early week. So, you know, from my side, I wanted to have that day business, but it's a tough one. It's not like the US or Great Britain or Asia in the sense of, you know, there's no free martini lunches going on. Uh-huh. You know, people are very conservative in the daytime and then they kind of let their hair down at night or get a cut.
Okay. Let their hair down or get it cut. That's great.
Yeah.
So what other kind of services do you offer besides haircuts?
Right, okay, we do the traditional hot towel cutthroat shave.
Hot towel cutthroat shave.
Yes.
That's a good one. I don't know that expression, cutthroat shave.
Right, okay.
It sounds kind of scary.
It does sound scary. It's not as scary as what it sounds. Yeah, basically, you know, you get the hot and cold towels. You get moisturized after it. And, you know, we give the closest shave that you can possibly have. It's a really nice experience.
Yeah, that's great. So what other services? Tell me a little bit more about the other things that you all offer.
Well, in Sydney and most parts of Australia, there's a big sort of subculture called hipsters.
Yes, do we know the hipsters. We have them here too.
They're everywhere. Yeah, so basically with the hipsters, you know, they like to, you know, keep their grooming up to scratch. So kind of beard trimming, mustache waxing and that kind of stuff.
Mikey, in your book, what's a hipster?
Well, that's an interesting question. Right, okay. A hipster generally is somebody with lots of facial hair. They manage and look after their facial hair. You know, they drink great spirits. Yeah, they eat great food. But they want to look like a down and outer.
Isn't that interesting? What do you think's driving that need to want to look like a down and outer?
You know, it's like most things, it's another trend that they're going through.
Okay, so before you were a cocktail enthusiast and bartender, you were a barber. So how did you set out on that course as your life's work originally?
Okay, you're going to love this one. Basically, when I was growing up in England, I wanted to move to Australia. You know, I love England, but I didn't want to live there. So back in the late 80s, if you basically studied and trained as a hairdresser, they were in demand in Australia. So you could get a visa a lot easily.
It was all about your dream of the sun.
Yes.
So there's the barbershop, but then there's also the bar. So what's the experience like in the bar? I think you have to walk through the barbershop to get to the bar. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. Yeah, so basically the barbershop is open from 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. every day. So, you know, if you arrive at the bar before 8 p.m., then you get to walk through the barbershop and see the guys working and doing their craft. The actual cocktail bar itself is predominantly a gin bar. Yeah, you know, we stock a lot of different gins. We have a lot of different style gin cocktails. The barbershop has three chairs, got 120 capacity in the back. So, you know, we have a pretty good atmosphere.
Sounds like quite a party. So you actually do have the largest rare and modern gin and Jennifer collection.
Yes.
How many gins?
Oh, we've got probably just over 100 at the moment.
And a lot of people may not even know who are listening what Jennifer is. Explain that.
Yeah, okay. So Jennifer is basically the first original gin. Yeah, it's juniper-focused. It does have a slightly different taste, but Jennifer came before gin.
Ah, and yeah. Where does it originate from?
Holland.
So do you make mixed drinks with that too?
Yeah, we have a pretty, you know, sizable Genever collection. A lot of those Genevers that we do have, you can't get in Australia. So we get them straight from Holland, from the House of Bowles. It is very different, you know. Basically, the term Dutch courage comes from Genever. Yeah, so when they went out to war, they used to have a slug of Genever. Yeah,
and
so
then
that's
you'd
quite
be ready to
fact.
Jump into the battle, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And then you go to war on a nice note.
Well, I guess maybe you might have a slug of Genever and want to do some other things besides make war.
That's a very good point. Maybe love.
Well, Mikey, describe for me some of the cocktails that you might be mixing there. What are you doing that's different, surprising? I mean, you've gotten an incredible amount of recognition for your cocktail bar. You know, you were a Tales of the Cocktail finalist in Best New International Cocktail Bar. The Australian liquor industry named your bar Best New Bar. Everybody's like all over what you're doing. What are you doing that's so different and special besides the haircut and a cutthroat?
We pride ourselves on all the best service that we can possibly give, and outside of that, you know, the best ingredients too. With cocktails, you know, we're quite experimental in terms of we use like lots of fresh fruits, and we use custard apple, rhubarb, which is traditionally English.
What's a custard apple? I think a lot of people might not know what that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, it's a hybrid of an apple. It's not something that you could chew on. It doesn't hold much moisture, so you've got to put it through a slow press juicer. And then you get like a kind of fluffy texture of an apple. Oh. It's very soft compared to like, you know, your regular sort of style apple. So it's like a hybrid. So we use lots of interesting ingredients like that. We also, you know, give a bit of a nod back to the historic record of gin cocktails. You know, we do lots of different variations on classic gin cocktails too. At the moment, I'm working on a hair care range.
A hair care range.
Yes. So I'm working with a scent house. So we're looking at putting the scent of gin into hair cream, moisturiser, beard oil, shave cream, and the likes.
Well, that's a regular manly scent, isn't it?
Yeah.
Nothing like a little scent of juniper.
Well, I just think that, you know, I think the future is really, from what I can see, is, you know, you broaden that creativity. And as it turns out, a lot of the botanicals that you do find in gin are beneficial, you know, to hair, skin and nails, you know. So, I mean, you know, it's all good for you too.
Mikey Enright, owner of the Barbershop in Sydney, Australia. That's it for this week's Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week as we tour the Old New Orleans Rum Distillery and witness firsthand the dedication that goes into every bottle.
We're in there with the bottles, with the machinery, really working it. This is not an anonymous factory without humans in it. This is very old school on that level. We're engaged in every step of this process.
Subscribe to our podcast. Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, by Tableau, Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant, serving local Creole cuisine with a view of Jackson Square, and by Toujac's Restaurant, home of America's oldest stand-up bar, now celebrating 160 years on Decatur Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.